Welcome to Narkeese Bible Study. It's the 7th of April, 2018, of course. Some of us are still getting used to that fact. And we are in the triennial parasha. Does that mean anything to anybody?
Yes.
Some of the regulars, yes. So we're reading through the whole first five books of the Bible on a very slow pace compared to nowadays, Jewish communities around the world read through it all in 1 year. They start on the same day, they finish on the same day. But we're trying to go back in time around the first century, how they were reading the Bible, and it took longer. And it actually didn't finish exactly on the same day. And it's a slower pace. And so it connects up naturally with things in the prophets that are slightly different than the Haftarah or the prophetic sections for today's readings. And so it's just been interesting for us and enlightening to go through and read these. We have a section from the Torah, and it's matched. Think of it as a main course, Torah, dessert, prophets. So you want to match your meal, something that goes together. And I think Jesus and his disciples would have been sitting around and discussing these texts in this kind of way. And so that's why we're doing it and seeing what might come of it, what new revelations can come from the text. I'm so sorry we started on time. Actually, we haven't officially started because I haven't prayed yet, so you're all good. Welcome. Yes, we've got... Brian brought them for us. We have Lois's book here. So now that we're all here, let's pray. Lord, thank you so much for being you, your graciousness, your mercy, your justice, and your love. Thanks for bringing each person here this morning. I pray you would bless their lives and speak to them in exactly where they need to be spoken to. Help us as we discuss your word, give us your insights, your passion, your excitement, and show us new things. In Jesus' name. Amen.
Amen.
So let's write up these sections. We're in Numbers 3. So the beginning of Numbers 3 all the way to 4:16. The other nice thing about this Bible study is it kind of forces you to read texts you otherwise maybe wouldn't read, because a lot of us skip over texts that we're not familiar with or that don't seem relevant to our lives. And yet every once in a while, actually plowing through those texts can have an advantage for you, can have a benefit and produce some hidden insights. Okay, and so this text in the Torah is going to be paired with Isaiah 45:19, following. And also, the Mountain of the Lord passages, which is very interesting to me, Isaiah 2 and Micah 4, for those who know or those who don't know, it's the same passage almost in two prophets. So, let me see what, so Isaiah 2:3, I'm going to put a slash, Micah 4:2. And I personally see the connection more with the first two than the Mountain of the Lord, but we can all talk about it.
I got that.
You got it?
I thought so.
Gemma's got it. All right. So what we do is we're going to go around and read the passages to make sure we've all got it uploaded in our mind, and then we'll be able to hopefully discuss them and the connection between them. So if you all will go to Numbers 3, and everyone can just take a chunk And we'll just read through the circle. So, Gemma, do you want to start us off?
Yeah. Now, these are the records of Aaron and Moses when the Lord spoke with Moses on Mount Sinai. And these are the names of the sons of Aaron: Nadab, the firstborn, and Abihu, Eleazar, and Itamar. These are the names of the sons of Aaron, the anointed priests, whom he consecrated to minister as priests. Nadab and Abihu had died before the Lord when they offered profane fire before the Lord in the wilderness of Sinai, and they had no children. So Eleazar and Itamar ministered as priests in the presence of Aaron and their father. Shall I go on a tiny bit?
Sure.
And the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, "Bring the tribe of Levi near and present them before Aaron the priest, that they may serve him. And they shall attend to his needs and the needs of the whole congregation before the tabernacle of meeting, to do the work of the tabernacle. Also they shall attend to all the furnishings of the tabernacle of meeting and to the needs of the children of Israel, to do the work of the tabernacle. And you shall give the Levites to Aaron and his sons. They are given entirely to him from among the children of Israel. So you shall appoint Aaron and his sons, and they shall attend to their priesthood. But the outsider who comes near shall be put to death." Verse 11.
The Lord also said to Moses, "I have taken the Levites from among the Israelites in the place of the first male offspring of every Israelite woman. The Levites are mine, for all the firstborn are mine. When I struck down all the firstborn in Egypt, I set apart for myself every firstborn in Israel, whether human or animal. They are to be mine. I am the Lord." The Lord said to Moses in the desert of Sinai, "Count the Levites by their families and clans. Count every male a month old or more." So Moses counted them as he was commanded by the word of the Lord. These were the names of the sons of Levi: Gershon, Kohath, and Merari. These were the names of the Gershonite clans: Libni and Shimei, the Kohathite clans: Amram, Izhar, Hebron, and Uziel, the Merarite clans: Mahli and Mushi. These were the Levite clans according to their families.
To Gershon belonged the clans of the Libnites and the Shimeites. These were the Gershonite clans. The number of all the males a month old or more who were counted was 7,500. The Gershonite clans were to camp on the west behind the tabernacle. The leader of the families of the Gershonites was Eliasaph, son of Lael. At the tent of meeting, the Gershonites were responsible for the care of the tabernacle and tent, its coverings, the curtain at the entrance of the tent of meeting, the curtains of the courtyard, the curtain at the entrance of the courtyard surrounding the tabernacle and altar, and the ropes, and everything related to their use.
Okay. Got a lot of names here. To Korath belonged the clan of the Amramites, and the clan of the Izharites, and the clan of the Hebronites, and the clan of the Uzielites. These are the clans of the Korathites. According to the number of all the males from a month old and upward, there were 8,600 keeping guard over the sanctuary. The clans of the sons of Korath were to camp on the south side of the tabernacle with Eliezerim, the son of Ezeel, as chief of the father's house of the clans of the Korathites. And their guard duty involved the ark, the table, the lampstand, the altars, the vessels of the sanctuary, which the priests minister and the screen, all the service connected with these. And Eleazar, son of Aaron the priest, was to be chief over the chiefs of the Levites and to have oversight of those who kept guard over the sanctuary.
From Merari came the family of the Mahlites and the family of the Mushites. These were the families of Merari. Those of them who were numbered, counting every male from a month old and upward, were 6,200. Now the leader of the clan and families of Merari was Zuriel, son of Abihail. These were to camp on the north side of the tabernacle. The appointed responsibilities of the Merarites include the frames of the tabernacle, its crossbars, its posts, its sockets, its utensils, plus all the service connected with these things, and the pillars of the courtyard all around, with their sockets, their pins, and their ropes. But those who were They were responsible for the needs of the sanctuary and for the needs of the Israelites. But the unauthorized person who approached was to be put to death. All who were numbered of the Levites, whom Moses and Aaron numbered by the word of the Lord, according to their families, every male from a month old and upward were 22,000.
The Lord said to Moses, "Count all the firstborn Israelites who are a month old or more, and make a list of their names. Take the Levites from me in place of all the firstborn of the Israelites and the livestock of all the Levites, in place of all the firstborn of the livestock among the Israelites. I am the Lord." So Moses counted all the firstborn of the Israelites as the Lord commanded him. The total number of firstborn males, a month old or more, listed by name, was 22,273.
And the Lord spake unto Moses, saying, "Take the Levites instead of all the firstborn among the children of Israel, and the cattle of the Levites instead of their cattle."
Thank you. Just repeating what she read. No?
No.
Oh, okay. Sorry. Oh, you're in 44. Okay, great. Sorry. Go ahead.
Okay. "And their cattle and the Levites shall be mine. I am the Lord. And for those that are to be redeemed of the 273, the firstborn of the children of Israel, which are more than the Levites, thou shalt eat, take 5 shekels apiece, as whole. After the shekel of the sanctuary shalt thou take them. The shekel is 20 gerahs. And thou shalt give the money wherewith the ark of the Lord of them is to be redeemed unto Aaron and his sons." To his sons. Moses took the redemption money of them that were over and above them that were redeemed by the Levites. Of the firstborn of the children of Israel took he the money, 1,365 shekels after the shekel of the sanctuary. And Moses gave the money of them that were redeemed unto Aaron and to his sons, according to the word of the Lord, as the Lord commanded Moses.
Adonai said to Moshe and Aharon, "Take a census of the descendants of Kahat who are among the descendants of Levi, by clans and families, all those from 30 to 50 years old. These will enter the court doing the work in the tent of meeting. Here is how the descendants of Kahat are to serve in the tent of meeting and deal with the especially holy things. When the time comes to break camp, Aharon is to go in with his sons, take down the curtain which serves as a screen, and cover the Ark of the Testimony with it. On that they are to place a covering of fine leather, and on top of that spread an all blue cloth. Then they are to insert the carrying poles. On the table of showbread they are to spread a blue cloth and place on it the dishes, incense, pans, offering bowls and pitchers. The perpetual bread is to remain on the table. They are to spread on these things a scarlet cloth, cover them with a covering of fine leather, and insert the poles.
They are to take a blue cloth and cover the lampstand that is for light, together with its lamps, its wick trimmers and trays, and all its jars with the oil used to supply it. Then they are to wrap it and all its accessories in a covering of hides of sea cows and put it on a carrying frame. Over the gold altar they are to spread a blue cloth and cover that with hides of sea cows and put its poles in place. They are to take all the articles used for ministry in the sanctuary, wrap them in a blue cloth, cover that with hides of sea cows, and put them on a carrying frame." That's that. "They are to remove the ashes from the bronze altar and spread a purple cloth over it. Then they are to place on it all the utensils used for ministering at the altar, including the fire pans, meat forks, shovels, and sprinkling bowls. Over it, they are to spread a covering of hides of sea cows and put its poles in place. After Aaron and his sons have finished covering the holy furnishings and all the holy articles, and when the camp is ready to move, the Kohathites are to come to do the carrying, but they must not touch the holy things or they will die. The Kohathites are to carry these things that are in the tent of meeting. Eleazar, son of Aaron, the priest, is to have charge of the oil for the light, the fragrant incense, the regular grain offering, and the anointing oil. He is to be in charge of the entire tabernacle and everything in it, including its holy furnishings and articles.
All right. So, what do we have here? What is this basically about?
It's about the duties of all.
The duties of all? Okay, specifically. Okay, so if we remember the beginning of the book we call Numbers, Bamidbar, what does it start with? A census, obviously the word numbers in English, and going back to the Latin titles of books, has to do with the theme. I see you brought your handout from the other week. We basically need to know how the people are going to camp. We need order in these mass amounts of people out in the desert. And so there's an order for everyone. There's a place for every family, and there's a job for everybody. It's kind of a beautiful picture. And some people like to make it into a cross, which is also a nice picture. We discussed how each tribe has its flag, has something, some symbol that represents them. And we no longer know exactly what that is, but we have guesses. There are some midrashic ideas that people have. And we discussed it last week or the week before, how they come partially from the blessings over the tribes in Genesis 49, partially from stories or other portions of the Bible, and then maybe people's own ideas put in there. But there is an order for each of the tribes. But our passage here is dealing with which tribe?
The Levites.
And it's very interesting because it seems to always keep a differentiation between Aaron and his sons and the Levites. He's supposed to be a Levite, yes. It's just interesting that he... He is. He's in this... He's supposed to be a Levite. If you remember Moses' whole family, it's Amram. But the chapter still differentiates between Aaron and his sons. Like, they are... You know, he's the high priest. They're in a special category from the rest of the Levites. But what verse did we read where it basically says the Levites are given to Aaron? Almost as if in verse 9 of chapter 3. You are to assign the Levites to Aaron and his sons. They will be assigned exclusively to him out of all the Israelites. So it's kind of a interesting thing going on. It's a bit confusing.
God keeps on saying that the Levites are his, they're mine.
Exactly. So the Levites are given to Aaron, but then the Levites are God's, because the firstborn are God's. That's what it all comes down to.
And Aaron's a firstborn.
Yes.
Yeah, Aaron's the older brother,
isn't he? But the Levites are supposed to stand in for the firstborn. So instead of God taking the firstborn out of all the tribes of Israel, he's saying, okay, I'm going to take the Levites. They will be the firstborn for me in terms of... So it implies that the responsibility of the firstborn would be to serve God in a special way, like to be the tabernacle people.
Maybe they're given to Aaron in the sense that they each have a part in putting together the tabernacle and everything.
Well, yeah, they are going to be... Yeah, they're the tzevet. They're the team for the tabernacle.
Team tabernacle.
And their numbers roughly correspond to the firstborn of Israel, but there is an extra on the firstborn side, and so they have to be redeemed. And so it goes into exactly how that happens. 5 shekels seems a little steep compared to the half shekel elsewhere.
Are they collecting that from the other people since they're serving? Where is it come from?
I think it comes from them. Those needing to be redeemed would give the money, and then it's given to the Levites.
I've lost you. Where does this come
from? Where are we talking about?
Yeah, where are we talking about?
We are talking about...
like verse 46.
3, what?
Verse, chapter 3, verse 46.
Right, I've got it. Take the Levites instead of all the first women. And the
okay.
The redemption of 273 of the firstborn children.
There's a odef.
There's more than the number of units.
There's small
you
change.
Take 5 shekels for each one individually.
It's the other tribes that exceed the Levites.
Well, see, the
they are redeemed, and that one is
okay.
The
so you have all the tribes of Israel. Let's say this group is the firstborn of all those tribes. And then you have the tribe of Levi. And you're saying this is going to take the place of this. But when you put them over, there's like this much that isn't accounted for. This group is slightly bigger than this group. And so that much has to be then redeemed. Sorry, I didn't draw that circle. You're
exactly opposite of what it should have been.
The interesting thing is it says that you shall take them in the currency of the shekel of the sanctuary, the shekel of 20 gerah.
Yeah.
And you shall give the money which excesses that is redeemed. So maybe the shekel of the sanctuary, 5 shekels on one level seems a huge amount. And yet maybe the rate of exchange or something is different. I don't know what 20 gerah means.
I'm pretty sure that it's... the other amounts are charged shekel of the sanctuary. That's the official exchange rate, right? The shekel of the sanctuary.
Right.
And at this point, you're talking about before there are coins. Things are literally just measured.
Right.
So you're weighing an amount of silver.
But it seems a lot of money. It seems a lot of five. Seems
well, it seems more than the pidyon ben elsewhere. That's
right.
Why.
That's what
struck me. But I haven't gone to research it, so I really don't, I can't account for it.
Well, the firstborn of the house, it's like redeeming your next generation.
Sure.
Because if you don't, like, you don't have anyone to succeed you except your secondborn, and so we find that the firstborn is generally the one that gets the bigger portion of everything,
right?
Gets
a double portion.
The more expensive.
Yeah. Yeah, no, but there seems to be a discrepancy between this passage and elsewhere in terms of exactly how much. But it could have to do with the fact that there are Levites. I don't know.
Well, wouldn't the Levites be standing in surrogates?
Yeah, they are standing in surrogate.
Well, the standard rate for redeeming a male between 1 month and 5 years is 5 shekels.
Oh, okay. So
that's 1.7.
Okay, so I'm thinking of the other,
what
the temple tax.
Well,
I'm thinking of the temple tax. That's the half temple.
27
the half shekel.
27 verse 6.
Right.
So, it's interesting that then the Levites become the firstborn, the metaphorical firstborn of God. And we also have... they don't receive a land portion because God is their inheritance. So that metaphor is continued. Also, they are the ones that camp. They essentially defend the tabernacle. They're right there around the tabernacle. If you noticed, what do the Gershon, the sons of Gershon, what do they do? Where do they camp? They're on the west?
The west.
And everybody needs a job. So when you're closing the tabernacle to move on, everybody's got a thing they do. So what does Gershon do?
They were responsible for the care of the tabernacle and the tent, its coverings, the curtain at the entrance to the tent of meeting, the curtains of the courtyard, the curtain at the entrance to the courtyard surrounding the tabernacle, and the altar and the ropes and everything related to their use.
So basically everything on the outside, right, of the tabernacle.
Or on the west side.
Well, the outside goes all the way around. The curtain around
right.
The whole chatzer
right.
Encircles it all.
The, the barrier.
The outer wall, you could see.
Yeah.
So you need a lot of people to carry all of that stuff. That's a lot.
Heavy curtains.
Heavy curtains. That's right.
And if they're traveling, who's carrying their stuff?
Their wives, their animals, their firstborn, but they're escaped along with them.
I guess all those firstborn animals dedicated from the rest of the tribes.
We'll just talk about carts later on.
Right.
Carts, yeah.
They don't need them.
And yet we see a lot of poles mentioned in this passage, right?
Yep.
Mm-hmm. And poles are not something you use if you have a cart.
Right.
Poles are something you use if you have people. Mm-hmm. Pole bearers, we talk about in English. The people carrying something on their shoulder. And there are two words for poles used in these sections. One is, you know, bad, that goes in, like the Ark of the Covenant, goes in the rings that are connected to it.
Bad.
Bad.
Like material, same word for material.
Like bet bad.
Yeah, bet bad. Like, it's like a pole. It's one of the words for poles. You're right that the word bad today does mean material.
Yeah.
Maybe there's a connection there. But the other one is mot. And mot is a big beam as well. And it's interesting that they go back and forth between the two. A lot of the utensils are supposed to be put in this cloth and then put on the mot, on a beam. So then the question is, you know, if the ark is carried like this, let's say,
mm-hmm.
is the other one carried like this, hanging? It doesn't say hang, it just put it on the beam. So it's a little mysterious how to do that.
It's interesting because I remember you've always said that if you're in the job, you know what to do.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we don't know. So
right.
This is like a sort of an itinerary list. You know, you're having a party.
Well, there's information that the writer assumes you know, and so doesn't bother mentioning.
Right, would be like here, I don't know, lay the table.
Sure.
You know, we say lay the table, and if you don't
it
have
means
to say
put a
plate,
fork, spoon, whatever, yeah.
cups or whatever on it. You don't have to say that. You just
You're right.
Say lay the table
because people know it.
And
right.
This is a little bit the same.
Yeah, and even coming from it years later and maybe from a foreign culture, you see that there are a lot of details, but when you actually try to think, how would I practically do that, you become aware that there's a whole lot of more details
right.
that you don't know.
Right.
That would be helpful if you're actually going to try to do it. We might be getting slightly ahead of ourselves. We'll just jump there anyway. But notice from Gershon, we go to Kehat. And what is their responsibility?
Go to whom?
Kehat.
Oh, the next verse, 27.
Yeah?
Everything to do with the ark and the table.
Where are the ark and the table and all of that?
Inside.
Holy of Holies.
Yeah.
This is dangerous stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And it specifically says at the end of the passage that Aaron and his sons have to wrap up everything because the people carrying it can't actually touch it. So think of like nuclear energy. The people dealing with it have to have special precautions to be near it because it could backfire. So Kehat has actually a very serious job to perform. And later on in Numbers, we'll read that some of his followers are rebellious and they do lose their lives. Not in touching the holy things, but in presuming to be a higher station than they are.
We've already had that. I mean, we've already had the story of Aaron's two sons.
Yes, and it's reminded here in this passage.
Again, in passing, but I mean, the message always is, if you touch the things of God inappropriately, I always have this thing, I'll do it my way.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you decide I'll do it my way, the Lord takes you out.
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
Yep. So I'm assuming hundreds of years later that these practices remain the same. So then when we think about David and his friend Uzzah, who touched
yeah.
it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He wasn't even touching the ark itself. He was touching the very outermost...
The bowl of poles. He was trying to stabilize it.
Right. And he didn't even touch the skin that was underneath the curtain on the outside. He wasn't even touching the inner court curtain itself.
Mm.
He was just trying to stabilize it.
It's today's Haftarah, which goes with the main parasha of today, because the two go together.
Mm. Yeah.
It's just you've got the what are the guys called? Aaron's sons called?
Aaron's sons?
The ones who died in
Nadav and Avihu.
Nadav and Avihu go together in the readings with
Which again, the strange fire is a bit of a mystery. We don't know exactly what it was, and people suggest different things. One suggestion is doing the right thing at the wrong time. Like there's certain appointed times to do things, and again, you know, doing it your way, like ignoring God's specific instructions, basically leads to trouble.
It does follow on this concept of really the total burnt sacrifice.
Others based on putting two contexts together immediately after, in the original story, it says, don't be drunk when you go into the presence of God. And so one suggestion was that they were doing their job drunk. Mm-hmm. That was a problem. And of course, we have creative interpretation based on this passage. You notice what it says here? They died and they didn't have any sons. So there is also a creative interpretation. I forget where it is, but that they were homosexual and that's why they didn't have sons. And
wow, I never heard that one.
Yeah, it's in there somewhere. But the point is that we don't know what strange fire is, and people try to fill it in based on the context. And it does remain a little bit of a mystery. Like, you can come up with your favorite idea, but just remember that it is still a mystery a little bit. The bottom line is, like Gemma says, you have to take God's instructions seriously. And if you're taking them seriously, then you shouldn't be in danger of death. Okay, but Kehat, you know, they have a big responsibility to carry those holy articles. And we're going to come back to this in a second when we read the Isaiah, because it's a very interesting contrast. And it just really makes you think, or it really makes me think, the contrast between these two, the comparison. Because as we read this, we're going to be invited to make a comparison, basically. What else was I going to say about this initial text? There's a sense. Oh, it's also different. There are two censuses going on.
Mm.
One is from 1 month old and on. That's kind of more like your generic census. But then notice for the Levites, how do they count them? What ages?
30 and up.
30 to 50. And it's compared to war. I don't know if you're in your translations it comes across.
Where are you?
But all who come for war, or all who enter war, tzava, which is also duty, it's service. Like the whole nation is described as an army, right?
What verse are you
in? I am in verse 3 of Numbers 4. So all who come, it's kind of a parallel to war, only in the sense you're not going to war, you're going to the service of the tabernacle. But age 30, that seems pretty old by ancient measurements. You know, you think of people in their 20s as strong and whatever, but 30 to 50.
I mean, you could begin to see these people as the patriarchs of their specific houses.
Yeah.
You could see these people as the elders of the community.
Certainly, there's a little bit more of a maturity required. It's not just all about brute strength, I guess you could say.
So they aren't really entering service until they're 30. They can be a Levite, but you're not entering service until they're 30.
That's right. According to this passage, yes.
It almost sounds like having proved themselves that they know how to follow directions, and they can
trust
it.
Right.
Right.
The this relate to Yeshua's ministry starting at 30? Is that in
the I mean, maybe. Maybe.
Elsewhere it talks about, this is chapter 8, it talks about starting at the age of 25.
Uh-huh.
No, this is specifically for the Levites.
Yeah.
One thing I've heard about that is are those 5 years of 25 to 30 years of training?
Mm-hmm. Mentoring or something, or figuring, like seeing how it's done as an assistant so that when it's actually your responsibility, you know how to do it. 5 years is a long time. That's good. You would have complete mentoring.
But early, in other places, you get, you know, you're not allowed to go to war. I think until you're 20, isn't it? Isn't there a figure 20?
Yeah, there is a figure 20.
So it's like.
So this seems even more than that.
Much more like the elders, like the people really know what they're doing, the people who have learned to be under authority, but also actually exert authority. They're the pastors, let's say. I don't know.
And yet, it does have to do with physical strength as well, because you have a top limit of 50. So they're also assuming after 50 you might not be able to carry the poles with these heavy things as well. You know, there's
so then you become.
It's a mix.
You become.
It's interesting. The other thing, what are the materials that keep getting repeated to cover all these things?
Blue cloth.
Blue cloth, trelet, which is made out of.
The blue dye that was used for royalty.
Blue dye for royalty. Again, the ancient world. If you have color at all, it's very specific. These aren't artificial colors that you can create anything. So certain shells, certain.
Blue dyes were the least expensive.
Blue and purple, I think, both come from snails and shells in different. Blue and argaman.
Yeah.
And the last person I was talking to seemed to say it was a different process to extract, like that it was the same shell, but a different process extracts different colors. Do you know something on that?
And the other two crowns, I'm not sure about the process, but it was super expensive because you could get only a certain amount of color from each shell.
From each shell, yeah.
You would have to dive beneath the ocean and look under like crags and rocks to find these snails.
The certain shells.
So they were hard to find, hard to
expensive
colors. Yeah.
The other thing that struck me when we were reading is we had at least three different interpretations of leather.
Yeah.
I've got badger. Somebody else
well,
leather,
okay, so this is just a problem
you
of
had something really
sea cow.
Sea cow.
It's tehash.
What?
Tehash. Tehashim. Tahash. Tehashim.
Tehash
is the word.
It's the word.
Tehashim. It talks about old tehashim, and the question is,
what is it?
What is that? Question is, what is that in Hebrew? And when you can answer that question, then you can figure out what is that in English. So people go different directions. One is, historically, if they're leaving Egypt, what would be the animal that would seem to be something they could both get and would have the functionalities that we presume it's intended for, such as slightly waterproof. And so then sea animals like hippo or dolphin, the Aramaic translation is dolphin, and so that's the one that has been very popular since it's something they could get down in the Gulf.
How does that even look like a cow?
Well, it doesn't say anything about cow.
Sea cow.
No, a sea cow would then be...
Manatees?
Yeah.
Manatee,
oh, okay, yeah. So manatee, it's in the same family.
Yeah.
It's also got waterproof skin, basically. Soft, it's fine leather. Mm-hmm.
And running around looking for badgers seemed a bit unusual.
And it's bigger. I mean, you'd take a lot of badgers to get any kind of covering. But it's also accessible if you're near waters, like down in the Gulf of Aqaba, there are a lot of dolphins, and I don't know about manatees, but maybe there used to be.
Until they built the tabernacle, they were all over, but they got rid of all.
Yeah. Like the quails brought in especially.
Oh my gosh.
I don't know. Hippo would be a larger piece of leather every hippo. You'd go through fewer hippos, I suppose.
Manatees are really big, too.
Yeah, manatees are big, but hippos are bigger.
Yeah.
Hippos are also...
I don't know. Have you got so many? hippos don't.
Hippos, we have bones.
Do you have hippos in the garden?
Let me tell you about hippos. This is the little bit I know about hippos. If you go to Tel Kasila today, the museum by Eretz Israel Museum, Tel Aviv University, there is a Philistine temple there, and you have two pillars, similar to, you know, the whole Samson story, and they have an altar, and they found hippo bones there, and dog bones and pig bones. So apparently Philistines sacrificed hippos and dogs and pigs and all kinds of things the Israelites did not sacrifice. So I only bring that up to say, basically up to Yafo, that's pretty far up the coast, they got hippos, or they brought hippos, so hippos are around.
Either animal would have been kosher.
Hippo?
Yeah.
Would not.
No?
Would not.
No.
Why would a hippo be kosher?
I'm thinking like there are no...
It
needs to be cleft foot and chew cud.
So then,
and if it's a water creature, it needs to have scales and gills. So I don't think the hippo can be kosher.
Maybe they were
dolphin, no.
Because they're not eating them.
No, here they're not eating them. Kosher rules
about eating.
Clean and unclean is all about eating laws.
But
you can use them for anything else.
It does say don't even touch their skins or whatever.
Well, touching the skin will make you unclean, but touching any skin, the people doing the sacrifices of clean animals become unclean when you touch a dead skin. Any death is going to make you unclean temporarily. Yes, absolutely. The person who slaughters a clean animal and has to take their skin and their dung outside the camp, they become unclean until they wash and then they come clean again.
Maybe you're thinking of the biblical sacrifice.
The meat itself doesn't make you unclean, but the slaughtering and the skins and the stuff, it is touching the blood. I mean, that makes you unclean. I guess we're kind of digressing a bit, though. Let's.
Okay.
We'll be
right. So we're.
I only bring this up because if you're actually trying to do it, it's a little complicated. Specifically, the table of presents, or the bread of the presents, you notice, it's supposed to stay on the table. Like, how many of you, if you were transporting a table, would leave it set? Say, let's just wrap it up, carry it. You know, that seems crazy. Because how would it not spill off? So I'm trying to think to myself, how did they carry this stuff? Like, they have it all set out on the table, and then they wrap it up, and then they cover it again. And
well, it's possible that there are cords that are there that are not mentioned.
Sure.
Yeah.
And it could be the leather covering has a snap, and it just fits snugly in place. But so, in a sense, it's kind of like, why? You have this concept of even on the move, it's like ready. It's already in position to go. So that's kind of nice. It seems practically a little harder, though. To me, it would be easier to throw it all in a box or throw it all in a sack. And maybe indeed there were parts that did go in a sack on the side. But specifically the table, if you just read it, doesn't seem to be that way.
I don't think you would have survived carrying that kitchen. Just throw it in a sack.
Yeah. Yeah.
He would have been disqualified.
You mean killed?
Maybe that would be the difference between the treatment of a pagan god versus a real living god who actually has a house. You know what I mean? If you were living in a tent and you could like just pick up and move to a different spot, maybe it would be nice just to say, hey, I'm just going to move like a mile today. Why should I pack everything up? Only have to like reset everything.
Oh,
why
I see.
Flat ground. Pretty much.
Right. Until you get to Jerusalem.
Yeah.
Well,
it's interesting that the only other thing I noticed was that talking again, don't cut off the families of the Kohathites from among the Levites because of what they're doing, but Aaron and his sons will go in and appoint each of them to his service and his task, but they shall not go in to watch while the holy things are being covered, lest they die.
Mm-hmm.
So you can't touch it. You can't even watch it. I mean, the guys who've got the covering are doing the covering, and they're okay.
Yeah.
But you don't go in and watch organize it. I mean,
yeah.
And say...
Yeah, there's like level of responsibilities. Like the holiest stuff has the fewest circle, Aaron and his sons.
It's a sort of reinstatement all the time of God is holy. I mean, he says
yeah,
it all the time.
Absolutely.
I am the Lord. I am Adonai. I am the one.
Yeah. And holiness is quite overpowering.
And the holiness is very overpowering.
Again, the holiness that is attributed to God reveals a level of respect that is required of the Levites, of the people who are building his house to different places.
Mm-hmm.
With a people that have a God that doesn't necessarily require all this responsibility and respect. They could probably throw all of these utensils in a box and just pick up and go.
Mm-hmm. It's hard to say, though, because I don't have a lot of writings from Canaanite pagan religions to be able to compare on that level.
Right.
And it would be so great if we did to really know down to the detail what the comparison is, because there's always a comparison.
Well, if they're in transition from Egypt to Canaan, you can look to Egyptian.
Sure, you can look to Egyptian. And not everything is going to be an exact equivalence. For instance, Egyptians do have temples that have levels of holiness.
Right.
And so there is some similarities there, but nobody's got a temple that migrates. And so that's already an anomaly. And so how you pick up the camp and migrate is probably not going to be in
for me, it's more
in the other categories.
Just watch. You just don't watch it all. You're either part of it, either this God you are, you understand who this holy God is, and you want a relationship with him, or he wants a relationship with you.
Right.
But you're not just an outside observer.
Right.
Sure. Everybody has its role.
I was thinking even in current terms. You know, you don't go to some amazing, I don't know, worship service just to sit on the edge and watch everybody saying hallelujah.
You have to do something.
You're either part of it or you're not, but you're not to sit there and watch on the outside.
Right.
It's called the bread of the presence. And what I'm getting
that's true.
Is that we don't just put everything in a box and move. God is present while we're moving.
While we're moving, exactly.
The tabernacle is up, but the tabernacle is down.
Yeah.
And so it doesn't.
And it's specifically the bread of the presence where you have the sentence saying, this has to stay on the table. So, yeah, it's interesting. So before we run out of time, let's read this, because you keep bringing up foreign gods, and I think that's great, because we're going to get that in the Isaiah passage. So turn to Isaiah 45:19. And what was your name?
Liza.
Liza, why don't you start us off reading a little bit?
Okay, Isaiah chapter
45, verse 19.
I have not spoken in secret. From somewhere in the land of darkness, I have not said to Jacob's descendants, seek me in vain. I, the Lord, speak the truth. I declare what is right.
Yeah, go ahead.
Gather together and come. Assemble, you fugitives from the nations. Ignorant are those who carry about idols of wood, who pray to gods that cannot save. Declare what it is to be presented. Let them take counsel together. Who foretold this long ago? Who declared it from the distant past? Was it not I, the Lord? And there is no God apart from me, a righteous God and a Savior. There is none but me. Turn to me and be saved, all you ends of the earth, for I am God and there is no other. By myself I have sworn, my mouth has uttered all integrity, a word that will not be revoked. Before me every knee will bow. By me every tongue will swear. They will say of me, in the Lord alone are deliverance and strength. All who have raged against him will come to him and be put to shame. But all the descendants of Israel will find deliverance in the Lord and will make their boast in him.
Okay.
Portable thoughts.
That's right. And we should then also read the first bits of the next chapter, because it has to do with portable gods. Maybe Brian can read us a bit.
All right. How many verses?
That's a good question. Just start reading and let's see.
Okay. Bel bows down. Nebo stoops low. Their idols are borne by beasts of burden. The images that are carried about are burdensome, a burden for the weary. They stoop and bow down together, unable to rescue the burden. They themselves go off into captivity. Listen to me, O house of Jacob, all you who remain in the house of Israel, you whom I have upheld since you were conceived and have carried since your birth. Even to your old age and gray hairs, I am he who will sustain you. I have made you and I will carry you. I will sustain you and I will rescue you. To whom will you compare me or count me equal? To whom will you liken me that we may be compared? Some pour out gold from their bags and weigh out silver on the scales. They hire a goldsmith to make it into a god, and they bow down and worship it. They lift it on their shoulders and carry it. They set it up in its place, and there it stands. From that spot, it cannot move. Though one cries out to it, it does not answer. It cannot save him from his troubles. Remember this, fix it in mind, take it to heart, you rebels. Remember the former things, those of long ago. I am God, and there is no other. I am God, and there is none like me. I will make known the end from the beginning, from ancient times what is still to come. I say, my purpose will stand. I will do all that I please. From the east I summon a bird of prey. From the far-off land, a man to fulfill my purpose. What I have said, that I will bring about. What I have planned, that I will do. Listen to me, you stubborn-hearted, you who are far from righteousness. I am bringing back my righteousness near. It is not far away. My salvation will not be delayed. I will grant salvation to Zion, my splendor to Israel.
All right. So that's a good place to stop. And while we're at it, maybe we'll just jump to Isaiah 2:3. And Micah 4:2. Which are parallel.
You got it?
You want to read Isaiah 2:3?
Yes,
go for it.
Many people shall come and say, come and let us go up to the mountain of the Lord, to the house of the God of Jacob. He will teach us his ways, and we shall walk in his paths. For out of Zion shall go forth the law, and the word of the Lord from Jerusalem.
Okay, and same in Micah 4:2. Many nations will come saying, come, let us go up to the Lord's mountain, to the temple of Jacob's God, so we can teach his commands and we can live by his laws. For Zion will be, like this translation says, for Zion will be the source of instruction. The Lord's teachings will proceed from Jerusalem. He will arbitrate between many peoples and settle disputes between many distant nations. Okay. So, what did you see as a connection between the dessert and the main course? Between the prophets and the Torah?
They're also talking about carrying.
Carrying
their gods.
Carrying gods. It's very fascinating.
Although they were carrying the gods themselves, but the children of Israel were carrying everything that is required to serve God.
Yeah. Well, first, just the theme of carrying is in both, and so it invites you to make a comparison, and like Tali is doing, to make a contrast. So then we think, what is that contrast? Because here, he's ridiculing the people. How can you bow down to something you made yourself and that you can carry on your shoulder? So this idea, and also there's a carrying theme, God is carrying Israel.
Mm-hmm.
So, carrying Israel. And weighing out money, the kesef, the silver that you weigh out, in the first passage it's given to God as redemption, and in the second passage it's used to make the gods. Of course, how do you make a god? We have elsewhere in Jeremiah. If you were to make an idol, how would you go about doing it?
Melt down.
Before you melt down, what do you need?
Mold.
Okay, so there's molded gods that are just pure metal, but there's also gods made out of wood. Because think about it, if you have pure metal this size, it's a lot of metal and it's very heavy. If you have wood and then you pour the metal all around it, it works better. So in Jeremiah and other passages, they talk about selecting a nice piece of hardwood that's not going to decay and then pouring your gold or silver over it.
That's the interesting thing is that on one hand, Israel is being told to carry the presence of the Lord.
Mm-hmm.
And in Isaiah, the beginning of Isaiah, or the first reading, we've got God mocking the pagan gods for schlepping around.
For being something
gods.
You can carry and being made out of
just
metal.
Just made out of everything, because all the message goes through is, I am God. And then you end up in the bit that I love so much, come and let us go up to the mountain of the Lord.
Right.
Where have you got... It's not... It's
he
like
also
God.
Ridicules... Isaiah ridicules gods that have to stay in one place. Did you
right.
hear that?
But now, God is not saying his work coming in one... He's staying in one place. He's saying that you're going to come up and worship him in one place. That's
right.
Just like, you know,
sure, that is different. His presence isn't limited to one place, but there is a center of worship and
like
instruction.
It's almost like all the previous history, which is actually before them, is a bad imitation, you know, a fake. It looks like
mm-hmm.
what they're doing in a way, even though
right.
preceded.
Right.
So it's kind of saying this is make-believe and this is
right.
real.
This is the real thing.
Different.
So as Tali said, like in one, we're still carrying something. We're carrying something holy. We're carrying something divine. And yet, we're carrying all the utensils that serve God. We're not carrying the God himself. And the other, it's being ridiculed. You're actually carrying something that you bow down and worship. There's no bowing down and worshiping anything in the Numbers passage but God himself. The closest you get to carrying God would be the Ark of the Covenant. That is considered his throne, and the Shekhinah would be sitting on it, basically. Or emanating out of it as well. But certainly not confined to it. And the Ark itself is not a god. It's simply a throne. And so all these things, the table of the presence, the lampstand, the Ark, with its seat covering, they are all articles in the service of God, and they are not God itself. So that's a big contrast.
Is it linked? Is it linked with the journey through the desert where you've got fire and cloud and whatever, and that is the presence of God going before you, and then you
sure.
are carrying everything behind it in this
right.
in this order.
Right. Yeah.
You're not carrying God. You're following God, and God is protecting whatever.
Right.
But the...
However, God also says his Shekhinah is with the people, in their midst. So it's both.
Right.
Just as the way that before the crossing the Red Sea, there was a guard behind and in front.
Right.
His presence separated.
But it's following God.
He's not.
You put him there, he's not staying there, but in his
he's moving.
We are following the moving God.
Yeah, yeah, he is moving.
Follow me, yeah.
Yeah.
We have to follow after him.
Even though he does seem to reach eventually what do you call that? Permanent address?
Right.
He does have a permanent address here in Jerusalem, but. All of these passages you're carrying. And it's interesting to hear this theme of carrying. I think like we have to think about it a lot more to see what Isaiah is doing with that. Because, well, Isaiah 45, which seems to be reflecting a time when they're in the Babylonian captivity. And so this contrast with carrying gods and foreign gods. And I'm trying to think to myself, what would be the context that someone would carry an idol? Like, why?
Well,
taking it from the workshop to the temple?
In the Bible Museum, they have all of these different idols made out of pottery. And
mm-hmm.
really, it's just this shape that it looks kind of geometric, almost like the body of a guitar. But really, all you needed was something small enough to put in your pocket.
But wouldn't those be more household idols?
Not
like tefillin?
I mean, it represented Asherah, so
sure.
I don't know.
It's still household.
So. I don't know, because I'm thinking that these kind of idols are more for a formal sanctuary with all the gold and silver.
But they commonly would parade idols too.
That's true, yeah. So I'm thinking of some type of ceremony where you might be lifting. And so you have, again, these contrasted images, one where you're carrying God's utensils and one where you're carrying an idol that can do nothing. So one is the very presence of God and one just can't do anything.
Or maybe before you go to war, don't you carry your gods before you?
That can happen too. However, I mean, you think of the ark in 1 Samuel 4, and they have a battle, right? The Philistines are in Aphek, Israelis in, Israelites, however you say it, in Rosh Ha'ayin, and they're fighting.
The Philistines capture it.
And Israelis, Israelites think, well, you know, we'll win if we just bring the ark, right? Mm-hmm. We'll just parade out our God. And God's like, yeah, I don't work that way. And the ark gets captured. And however, when it does get captured, it does damage everywhere it goes. So it's both justifying this is the presence of God and there is power there. And yet don't think that you can just use me for your battles. Like, God is God and he's...
Or more specifically,
you can't just be used.
Make me into an idol and pray me the way they do.
Uh-huh.
To me, that's what I get from this. You can't use the
The purpose of parading is to say, we have this God in our battle, therefore we will win.
I'm all right, Jack. And then, of course, when it does get taken by the Philistines, it gets abandoned. What's the name of the guy? Obed-Edom.
It gets
stuck there because David's so angry with God killing off Uzziah? Isn't that
David? Well, that's much later.
Yeah.
We're talking Samuel's day. It comes back. No one wants to touch it. Everyone's afraid of it.
Right. And then when it does get stuck in the right place, it either brings trouble if it's with the wrong people, and
or,
it either brings
or
blessing.
Blessing.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it was done all this while in parallel.
What we would call good luck charms. People had carried all sorts of good luck charms from, I don't know.
Well, and then you have the book of Judges, right? And you have the tribe of Dan, and you have a Levite, this wandering mercenary priest, you could say. And he makes a nice little household god for someone and is their priest. So that's a very strange story there of kind of like you're saying, we'll just everyone just does it their own way, right? Mm-hmm. Instead of following this clear pattern. But there's also another tying in, different word maybe, but I think there's some overlap of carrying Israel, where God's ridiculing these other people for carrying fake idols, but he's like, but I will carry you. And I kind of like that because if you think back to Genesis 1, many years ago, we had a Bible study by Crispin Fletcher Lewis about why it's so wrong to make an idol. It's not just that it's idolatry. Obviously, that's wrong. But it's denying your own responsibility as a human, because humans are God's idol. Because it says in Genesis 1 that he created you, Betzelem Elohim. Tzelem, you are the image. You're the idol of God. You are supposed to represent God to the world. And so when you give up that responsibility and make an idol and say, this is a representation of God, not only is it wrong in denying the true God, but it's denying your role. And so it's like doubly wrong. So I was just thinking, it's an interesting metaphor and contrast when you have a ridiculing, carrying foreign gods, and then God says, I'm going to carry you. I just had that image of, you know, we are supposed to be the image of God, created in his image to reflect that to the world. And so obviously we don't always do a good job, you know, and yet it just shows God's grace of, I can carry you. And so I kind of like that. Again, there's a whole lot more. You could just meditate on these images and the connections and see what might be coming to mind. And the whole contrast of stationary and moving, because we have moving, stationary, and yet here the address is stationary, but the instruction is moving.
It's being raised.
It's being raised, but like the instruction, the Torah and the word of the Lord goes out. So the word of the Lord is still moving, even though he has a permanent address there. So there's some nice, contrast. And part of the foreign God thing being illegitimate is that they can't even move themselves. They just sit there doing nothing.
They don't have Shekhinah.
Yeah, they don't have ability to move. And God obviously has ability to move. So that's kind of a nice contrast as well.
So it's also God doing the moving. Mm-hmm. I mean, even going back to Numbers, he's setting up the sort of scenario, but the final act is he's the truck that actually carries them. You know what I mean?
Yeah, exactly. He's actually the mover.
You know, you put everything into your truck, you haul yourself or whatever the truck
is. He's the engine.
And he's the engine. He's the mover.
Yeah. He tells you when, and you have your job to get prepared, but then he's the engine and he moves.
Which, if you go deeper into theology, that has to be the primary mover, per se, or else there would be a power that would
move
that.
Exactly.
You know?
And that is what's hammered home, so to speak, in the Isaiah passages. I am it. I knew things from the beginning and the end. There's no other power moving me. And so again, back to the Philistine battle, you can't just pull God into your plans and say, okay, now I succeed because I have you here. I have, like, basically, I'll take your ring and just stamp it on my plan. It's like, no, God is God, and he initiates. And so if he says to bring the ark to the battlefield, you better bring it. But don't think that you can just decide by bringing it that it's going to guarantee your success. And I think this is a very fascinating one if you want to take the spiritual metaphor to the evangelical world. I think sometimes we do dangerous things because we kind of try to twist God's arm in a sense where I have you, I can make you guarantee my success. Where God is God. You know, he's holy and we have to be in awe of him. We cannot twist his arm.
You give me money into this nice ministry and I'll give you blessings.
But the nice verses for that, in verse 10 of the Isaiah 45 passage, my plan will be realized. I will accomplish what I desire. So when we pray the Lord's plan, let your will be done, we're not saying, like, just stamp my will. We're saying, let your will be done, and in essence, let me be a part of that. I'm once again trying to join into your plan, whatever that is.
What verse did you read from?
I read from verse 10 of Isaiah 45.
I've got something different. Woe to him who says to his father. I think it's probably...
Sorry, Isaiah 46. Sorry, yeah, 46. Because it's 45, 19 and following. I'm in verse 10. Sorry, 10 of chapter 46. So we do have to wrap it up here and go downstairs. I'll leave you with these things to think about and joining God's plan for your life today. And Shabbat Shalom.